Well, good afternoon, Juno, on a snowy little Tuesday. Let's see. We have about 3 o'clock on the clock here. You're in tune with KTOO News. This is Juno Afternoon. Pat Moore, your host today, and I have a good lineup of guests standing by for you. Dawn Colden will be here to tell us about the Young Company performance that's going on at Perseverance Theater. Ann Fuller will tell us about the Mudrooms presentation coming up tonight. Folks from the Alaska Youth Choir fundraiser will be here. They're doing a Lord of the Rings movie marathon Saturday at the Jack. We'll have Alec Mestag from AEL&P on to tell us a little bit about Juno's energy sources. And Principal Ted Wilson from Glacier Valley Elementary School will join us. We'll have Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, music, and more. The weather forecast, well, you're looking at it out the window. We have snow, and we will have snow until probably later tonight. And then it'll start mixing with rain, and then over the next couple, 3 days, it'll rain on it. And then it should chill down over the weekend. On Saturday, we should get more snow. And then on Sunday, it'll rain again. So a little snow, a little rain, all of those things. Stay tuned.
Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Service.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. On Monday, the last of the original 29 Navajo Code Talkers celebrated Veterans Day by graduating from college. Rhonda Livaldo in Lawrence, Kansas has more.
Coming together for graduation on Veterans Day, this one was special. Danny Anderson, Dean of the College of Liberal Arts, University of Kansas.
The awarding of Mr. Nez's degree reflects our aspirations for our graduates to change the world.
Chester Nez, a Marine veteran and one of the original 29 Navajo Code Talkers of the 382nd Marine Platoon, left the University of Kansas in 1952 after 3 years as a student, unable to finish his degree after using up his GI Bill funding. 60 years later, he finally received his degree along with many other gifts.
Our gift to you is your class rank.
Elliot Bryant, a member of the Navajo Nation, said it was inspiring to see Nez receive his degree.
It makes me feel very, like, renewed, honorable, encouraged our young people to pursue their degrees.
Corporal Nez expressed his appreciation to those who showed up for his graduation.
And I thank you, Jen. Thank you all.
For National Native News, I'm Rhonda Livaldo.
The South Dakota city of Box Elder held an honoring ceremony for Marine veterans of the Battle of Iwo Jima. As Jim Kent reports, last week's event was an opportunity to acquire some insight into a famous Native American military hero from Arizona.
If you've seen the classic photo or sculpture of the flag raising on Iwo Jima, the Marine with his outstretched hand reaching for the flagpole is Ira Hayes. Like the 4 other Marines and 1 Navy corpsman who took part in the historic event, the Pima tribal member became a hero to Americans during World War II. But Ira Hayes quickly became a victim of the American press after developing a drinking problem, the result of too many required Washington, D.C. celebration parties, according to his good friend and fellow former Marine, Jack Thurman.
Ira Hayes was a true-blooded warrior. He loved his country. And then to have the news media get a hold of him and tear him apart because he was got to drinking too much. That was something that bothers me to this day, that Ira Hayes didn't get the justice that he should have had.
Thurman recalls how Ira Hayes traveled all the way to his family's farm to visit the young South Dakotan he'd become close with during the horrors of combat. For National Native News, I'm Jim Kent in Box Elder, South Dakota.
In many places, votes are still being tallied and the impact of the Native vote is being measured. Tristan Autone reports on record turnout in Montana.
It's estimated that over 19,000 Native voters turned out to vote last week in Montana, making voter turnout in Indian country around 60%. Lauren Birdradler is executive director for Western Native Voice, a nonprofit voter engagement organization in Montana. He says a huge media campaign targeting radio and television stations as well as newspapers on and off the reservation was paramount to turning out Native voters, as well as a pilot program to get Montana's urban Native population to the polls as well.
The need for grassroots organizations much like ours, Western Native Voice and Western States, is tantamount to success. The major parties, or one of the major parties, will come in. They'll do a mass voter registration drive. They'll hire temporary workers. They'll push to turn out Native voters. And once the election's over, they pull out and leave nothing in place. And so the need for sustainable infrastructure is very obvious.
This year, 9 Native Americans have held or gained seats in the Montana State Legislature, and currently Denise Juneau, a Mandan Hidatsa tribal member, is still in the lead for the Office of State Superintendent of Public Instruction. Provisional ballots will be counted today to see if her 1,600-vote lead holds strong. I'm Tristan Ottone.
During this month in 1871, the San Carlos Apache Reservation in Arizona Territory was established. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation. Funding comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, the McCune Charitable Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and the Nathan Cummings Foundation. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
It's 6 minutes, a little bit more than that, about 6 minutes and 16 seconds after 3 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News. My first guest today on Juneau Afternoon is Dawn Colden. She's here from the Perseverance Theater Young Company. Dawn is directing a production of The Story of Ichabod Crane, which opens, I guess, Thursday night, right, Dawn?
Yes, it opens on Thursday night at 7:30.
Mm-hmm. So which Ichabod Crane are we seeing at this point? The tale has been told in many ways.
Yes, yes. I love this particular version. I read 3 scripts, and I actually thought this one was the hardest, and I chose the hardest, the most interesting to direct and challenge the actors. And this one, I like this one. Ichabod is, it's at the very beginning when he heads to Sleepy Hollow and starts teaching there, and he falls in love with Katrina and is challenged by Brom Bones and maybe meets the Headless Horseman.
Uh-huh. And don't give away the full story.
In
so
fact,
you're just weeks late. It should have been, you know, for Halloween.
Yes, but it was fun rehearsing during that time. Yeah.
Okay. So who all's in this?
Well, there's students that are ages 10 to 16 in it from all the different schools in Juneau. And some of the kids, it's their first time in Young Company, and some of them are veteran seasoned performers in Young Company.
So a little about Young Company. What is this?
Young Company has been around for a long time at Perseverance. It's a training ground for young actors, and it goes up to 16 years of age. And Young Company performs in the small space at Perseverance. And then sometimes Young Company also gets put in the main stage shows. So it's a training ground.
And is there a relationship between Young Company and STAR, which is a program that the University of Alaska Southeast has, and also it ties into to Perseverance?
Well, it's a relationship, meaning that some of the same kids do it, and it's under Perseverance's guidance and direction. But there isn't necessarily they're 2 separate programs. So one is during the school year, and one is in the summer. And in the STAR program, it's an intensive, and it's kids meet every day, but now it's different because kids have homework and other things going on. And so in some ways, they're learning a different skill to combine theater with their everyday lives.
So do you have people doing homework in between appearances on the stage and then rushing out and doing a line or two and then going back and finishing their math?
Yes, some students actually do their homework and some students don't.
Juneau doesn't have a real young people's theater, a children's theater. So this kind of fills that gap, I think.
I think you're right, and yeah, I think you're right. It fills the gap in giving them the training that they need to learn professional acting skills.
Yeah, other places I've lived, there were organized children's theaters, which I think there's a pretty good large one in Anchorage that does a couple, 3 plays every year.
Yeah, and they travel a little bit too. And,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but this one kind of fills that hole in our artistic setting, I guess. There are so many things going on here. Do you expect pretty reasonable houses for your shows?
We actually do usually sell out. I'm glad you said that, because we're not pre-selling tickets. We're going to do tickets right at the door, and a lot of people wait to come on the last day, Sunday at 2, and I would suggest coming Thursday, Friday, or Saturday also at 7:30.
Okay, so you have Thursday, Friday, Saturday, 7:30, and then a Sunday 2 o'clock matinee.
Yes.
So a total of 4 performances.
Mm-hmm, correct.
Now, that's a small space in there. How many people can you seat in there?
Oh, my gosh. I don't remember. So I can't. Maybe I'm going to guess, I don't know, 35 to 45.
Okay, so if somebody wants to see this, they need to make sure that they get there early enough to get a ticket.
It's true.
It's a sellout. It can be a sellout pretty easily.
Yeah, it can. It's great. Like, I think this is such a great production. I'm really proud of it. I'm really proud of the young actors, and it's just a great, scary, thought-provoking play.
Oh, thought-provoking. Well, a nice take on the Ichabod Crane legend that kind of makes you have to think about what's going on.
Yeah, we wanted to work really hard on not playing stereotypes, and also I'm letting Ichabod decide sort of how it ends in his mind, and of course I have how it ends in my mind, so it does leave you with that choice of wondering what happens, and also it brings up the time of Salem Witch Trials, and also if you believe in superstitions or not, or can you create your own fear?
Well, this does sound like a thought-provoking performance. Mm-hmm. Again, it's Perseverance Theater's young company. The performances are starting Thursday night at 7:30, and then Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and then a Sunday matinee. Dawn Colden is the director, cast of thousands, and the story of Ichabod Crane. What's the title of the play itself?
The title is The Legend of Sleepy Hollow.
The Legend of Sleepy Hollow.
Yeah.
Ah, okay. Well, wonderful. Let's have a little kind of mildly bouncy music to let Ichabod ride on here.
All right.
At Hearthside Books and Toys on Wednesday night, from 6 o'clock to 8 o'clock p.m., there's a presentation and book signing. The book signing at Hearthside Books is, I believe, all day with a number of authors, but featured in the midst of it is Amos, is the book Last Voyager, Amos Berg and the Rivers of the West. Author Vince Welch is up from Portland, and he'll be signing copies of his book at that. He's also giving a presentation and a book signing at the Juneau Public Library downtown. So the two locations, I'm pretty sure that the Hearthside Book and Toys is at the signing is at the Nugget Mall on Wednesday. So my next guests are here to talk to us about a program which started last year and has now gone through six iterations and one for this season, a total of seven, and seven is the magic number for this kind of thing. This program is called Mudrooms, and it's seven people who speak for 7 minutes each. And I think it was always supposed to be on the 7th of the month, but I'm not sure. But anyway, so with me are Ann Fuller, Katie Spielberger, and Rich Moniak. Tell me about what this program is.
Well,
this would be Katie.
This is Katie. Thanks for having us. Mudrooms is a live storytelling event. Basically, seven is the magic number. We have seven people. These could be your neighbors, your friends, someone you see around, someone you've never seen in town before. These are people who we might have an occasional professional storyteller, but it's largely people with little or even no storytelling experience getting up on stage and telling personal stories around a theme. Our theme for this evening is a brush with greatness. So we'll have seven stories, 7 minutes each, around this theme. Some of them might be funny, some of them might be sad, some of them surprising. We don't know exactly what we'll get.
So who are the seven storytellers?
See, our seven storytellers tonight are Norman Cohen, Bruce Botello, Courtney Nelson, Greg Kollwitz, Dave Noon, Ann Fuller, who's here with us, and Tom Cosgrove.
So it wouldn't be fair to ask what you're going to talk about, right, Ann?
Well, sure. I'll talk about
what are you going to talk about tonight, Ann?
I have a story that starts with an experience of meeting a great athlete and then learning lots more about that story. It's an interesting concept. These themes seem pretty broad. So brush with greatness. You know, does it count if you saw a president walking off a helicopter? I don't know. I mean, it counts as the only president.
Yeah.
But it turned out to be not, that's not the story I want to tell.
That's not the story you want to tell. So this has to do with an athlete.
Mm-hmm.
So each of these little 7 minute stories, how rehearsed are the speakers?
That depends upon the speaker, how comfortable they are getting up. I think, you know, with what Katie said about some people are practiced on the stage and some aren't. We're all experienced, actually, in storytelling. It's just we're not all experienced on stage. You know, we all tell stories, and it just depends upon how the individual feels that they can squeeze a story into 7 minutes and not lose it. And how nervous people might be. I was pretty nervous when I talked last year. I didn't practice enough, I thought. But I think, you know, I'm sure Amanda sends out a message on, you know, coaching people on how to prepare for it. It's up to the individual.
Amanda is?
Amanda Compton.
And she's the person who organized this.
Yes.
Now, as I understand it, the inspiration for the Mudrooms name and the nature of the program is from a thing that was started up in Anchorage. At least its first iteration in Alaska was started up in Anchorage, called something like
Arctic Entries.
Arctic Entries. So that was, and down here, of course, that would translate into Mudrooms because we don't need no Arctic Entries down
right,
here.
Right.
Never snows in Juneau.
All we have to deal with is mud.
Right. Right. So the seven people who will be talking, are they all from Juneau? That entire list. It sounded like I knew all those names.
Yeah, they've all lived in Juneau for, you know, anywhere from, you know, we have some relative newcomers, we have people who've lived here for decades. Yeah, it really runs the gamut, but they are all Juneauites. And
yeah, we have people
together.
Born and brought up in Juneau on this list. Yeah.
So this is your friends and neighbors up in front of you telling these stories. Yeah.
Okay. It is, and I think that's part of the allure to the audience, too, is you may know one of these names in one context, and then to hear the story. Margot Waring last month, and the story was from Spain, of all places, and something I had never talked to her about.
Rich, did Amanda recruit you into the fun that you did last year?
Yeah.
And when she came to you, what was your reaction?
Well, I was interested in it because I've been interested in stories for a long time, but I remember the first time she thought I might first time she asked me, I just basically said, no way, I'm too introverted to get up on stage and talk about anything, you know. And then she penciled me in anyways for May.
She has a tendency to do that.
But I expressed enough of an interest, I thought, you know, I should try it if I really believe this is a good thing. And a lot of it is about getting people that, like I said, aren't practiced storytellers in front of an audience. You know, you get people out. I remember Paul Shapiro talked at the For the Love of It in February, you know, and he's somebody I see at the gym a lot. Never knew who he was, and he told a nice, simple story about how he came to love jazz, you know. And to me, that's what it's about, is you get to know people you see on the street all the time in a totally different way.
Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think what the analog to this is. The one that comes to mind is that I've always wished that I had had a tape recorder when my father would have a beer and would begin to tell one of the stories of his past, because he was a quiet guy, and I never knew much about him, but occasionally he would get loquacious about the bottom of a can of beer, and would start talking about some wonderful thing like this. And I remember sitting there just being very quiet and listening to these stories that he would tell, which is the question I'm driving toward here. How does the audience respond to this? You've done it, and you've obviously been involved in the thing.
Yeah, so, I've done it.
Yeah, okay.
As well.
So,
yeah.
So how did you, were you connected to the audience? Did you feel connected?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, very, very much so. Both during the telling and afterwards. I mean, you get feedback depending on the type of story you're telling. You might get laughter or, knowing nods or from the people you can see. But the real reaction that was interesting to me, having told, was just afterwards, people coming up to me, both people I knew and people I didn't know, but people who were surprised or amused or moved by the story in some way. But also afterwards, I felt I had a connection with some people who I hadn't known before, but had heard the story and felt like from that story, maybe they knew something about me or knew me in a way that they didn't before. And I think as a listener, I felt that about hearing the story. I think it's a very personal experience, both sharing your story and hearing other people's stories. I mean, it forges these connections, which we like to think endure.
Oh, yeah.
Still connected?
Yeah.
So I meet new friends out of this? People that you didn't know before?
And find a common experience or a common perception that you didn't realize you had with somebody else?
Rich, you argued that you were an introvert. Now that you've been up there in front of your friends and neighbors for 7 minutes, has anything changed?
No, not really.
Okay.
I don't think I'd want to do it again, but, you know. I don't
nicely
know.
Put.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know either. You got to watch Amanda. She'll be all over you if she's got a slot open. Anyway, how about you? Did it change you anyway?
Yeah, I actually did do it again. I was in Sitka this summer, and the Sitka Speakeasy had a similar event, basically. You know, seven people telling.
Did you do the same
talk? No, it was a completely different story, and it actually terrified me again, even though I'd already told this story and I knew I enjoyed it and it was a positive experience. I thought, well, this other story, this doesn't work as a story. This doesn't have a good narrative arc. I can't do it. But I was, again, pressured into doing it, and it, again, turned out to be a really wonderful experience. And it was interesting doing it in a neighboring community where I know a lot of people, but it's not, you know, it's not my hometown. But it really, after doing that again, I felt a deeper connection to our neighbors over there.
Okay, so Juneau, you know everybody, all right? And you're up in front of them. Sitka, you don't know quite everybody.
Right.
So how does it feel from your standpoint? What were the differences?
I guess the difference when I did it in Sitka, nobody in the audience had heard the story before, which. When I told my story in Juneau, I knew I had at least a few people who knew it. But I had, it wasn't that different. I mean, it's kind of interesting because, you know, Sitka as a neighboring community still, I guess I had to do this storytelling experience there to realize that it was kind of maybe not a second home, but something akin to that for me as well. So I think it can bridge community even with even if you don't necessarily feel a part of that community, it can certainly help to bring you into the fold,
yeah.
Perhaps. So it's interesting where, of course, we do have lifelong Junoites telling, but we also have some relative newcomers telling, and I think that's really a nice way to maybe introduce someone to town as well, in some respects.
And you're going on tonight. Have you done this before?
I've told before. I've told from the stage and okay. Organized storytelling events. And one of the things I admire about Mudrooms is that right here in these years, there's an audience for storytelling without making it be stories for children or Halloween story. I mean, without saying what it's going to be about, we have the trust that we will come and hear some wonderful stories and learn some human things. So I was organizing storytelling events in general a few years back. I'm a storyteller, I don't know, by tradition and by dint of having a mother who knew who everybody was and how they were connected. And so, she didn't tell from the stage, but there was still a very formal way. And she would say, oh, well, that reminds me of, you know, Uncle Ken. You know about that story about Uncle Ken. You say, no, Mom, I don't. Well, you ought to know that story. She would wait until you said, yes, I want to hear that story. And then she'd ask you one more time, do you want to hear this story? Yes. Then she would tell. She never wasted a story on an inattentive audience.
So the event is Mudrooms. It's tonight at 7 o'clock. Seven speakers, 7 minutes each. It's at McPheeters Hall, right?
It's in that building.
It's in the building.
Upstairs.
Upstairs. Okay, it's in the church itself.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, excellent setting. Nice acoustics for telling stories. Okay, good. And it's $7, right?
Yes, and... Yeah. And all of the proceeds this season are going to the Imagination Library.
Okay.
And we raised.
Outstanding. Yeah.
We have treats for sale, and we have music. So Rod Crist and Darren Jenkins are coming and playing music in the intermission. So it's a whole evening package.
All right. So seven stories tonight at Mudrooms, 7 o'clock at the church at St. Anne's, right?
The Church of the Holy Trinity.
Church of the Holy Trinity. Okay, good. All right. So everybody knows where that is. It's up the hill. It's the one that got rebuilt after the big tragic fire last year and like that. Okay.
Right.
Thank you so much. And congratulations on your bravery and for going out there tonight and doing it.
It'll be fun.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday. It's the 13th of November, 2012. It's the day of the total solar eclipse. Today, Australia and New Zealand, the moon passing between the sun and the earth. It'll happen in Australia just an hour after daybreak, the most dramatic view in northern Australia in the city of Cairns. They'll have a complete darkness for around 2 full minutes. It's the birthday of Robert Louis Stevenson, Edinburgh, 1850. He was a sickly, moderately successful writer living in France when he took one look at a woman named Fanny Osborne and fell in love with her. She divorced her husband. They were married. They moved to Scotland. One rainy summer afternoon, he made a map of an imaginary island to amuse his new stepson. And in 1 month, Stevenson wrote his first great novel, Treasure Island, 1883, and went on to write Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde in just 3 days. Robert Louis Stevenson, who said, I travel not to go anywhere, but to go. I travel for travel's sake. The great affair is to move. It's the birthday of L.L. Bean, Leon Wood Bean, born Greenwood, Maine, 1872. He sold soap door to door. He was an outdoorsman, though, went hunting, trapping, and it was frustration with soaked feet in the wet, snowy winter that led him to invent a boot with a waterproof rubber sole and a leather upper. It was the Maine hunting shoe. He sold them by direct mail out of Freeport, Maine. The L.L. Bean Company was right upstairs from the post office. During the height of the Great Depression, L.L. Bean started issuing a seasonal catalog. Customers included Eleanor Roosevelt, Babe Ruth, and John Wayne. 1942 published his first book, Hunting, Fishing, and Camping, offering advice on hunting moose and reading a compass. L.L. Bean, who was still copy editing the catalog until he died at the age of 94. And it was on this day in 1933 that workers at the Hormel meatpacking plant, Austin, Minnesota, began the nation's first large sit-down strike. They sat down on the factory floor, and they refused to leave. Local townspeople sent them food and books and blankets. And a few days after it began, the workers in Austin won one of the nation's first industrial union contracts. Here's a poem for today by Michael Blumenthal entitled Sadness. Sooner or later, it comes to everyone. The beautiful prom queen who has lost a breast, the Don Juan of the 10th grade who has turned up impotent, the fleet chiropodist who has developed a limp. Sooner or later, it comes, and you are never prepared for it quite yet. You, who had hoped to be spared through another epoch of your rightful happiness, you, who had always given to charity, like a gargantuan tackle lumbering toward you. It comes and comes, and though you may double lateral all you wish, though you may throw a perfect spiral up the middle to some ecstatic receiver and be blessed blue-green some night by the ministrations of strangers, it will not spare you. It comes and comes, inevitable as sunrise, palpable as longing, and we must go on laughing it right in the face until it learns to sing again. Sadness, a poem by Michael Blumenthal, from No Hurry Poems, published by Etruscan Press, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac. Supported by Reputation.com, a service for managing businesses' online image by working to improve how they look in search engines and review sites, Reputation.com. Written by Joy Biles, produced by Nick Vedder. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
It's that time again. The KTOO Winter Radio Auction is happening December 8th, and we'd love for you to be a part of this unique advertising opportunity. We need your donations, and the sooner the better. If you're a business owner, artist, or anyone else who has something of value to bid on, we're looking for your donations by November 16th in order to be in our auction catalog. Contact the auction coordinator at 723-1884 or email at auction@ktoo.org or stop by the station. Thanks.
Well, if you're a fan of the movies, you recognize that the theme in the background is straight out of The Lord of the Rings, and my next guest is here to tell us about what's going to happen with The Lord of the Rings this weekend here in Juneau. I am here with Tony Newman, and Tony is going to tell us about a fundraiser for the Alaska Youth Choir. Hi, Tony.
Hi, Pat. How are you?
So what's shaking?
Well, this Saturday we're going to show all three Lord of the Rings movies in one after the other in the entire day, starting at 11 o'clock and ending at hopefully around midnight. The idea for this came a couple of years ago with some friends and I who said, you know, one day we ought to just sit down and watch every movie from start to finish in one single lazy day. And more of my friends said they wanted to be in on this, so we realized none of us had a home big enough to contain us all and kind of let it die. But then I was serving on the board of the Alaska Youth Choir, and we were looking for new and different fundraising ideas, and this idea occurred to us that we could try and turn it into a community event, hopefully raise a little money, but more than that, just try and bring the community together to have a good time.
So the event is going to take place where? It's not going to be in your front room.
No, not in my living room anymore. It's going to be at the Juneau Arts and Culture Center, the Jack, on Saturday, November 17th. And we're going to have refreshments. Folks involved with the choir are going to be bringing refreshments. We're going to be making popcorn and selling caffeinated drinks for people who need help staying awake throughout the day. And we'll also have door prizes to give away. We're going to have a trivia challenge for the real Lord of the Rings buffs, and costume contest.
Contest as well.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. So are you coming dressed?
I am.
As?
I'm not quite sure yet, but I'll think of something. I'll think of something. You know, the movies are a lot of fun, and with The Hobbit coming out later this year, next month, it's a great time to immerse yourself in that world and get excited about The Hobbit coming out.
Tony, the benefit for this goes to the Alaska Youth Choir, and there are a number of things on the horizon for the Alaska Youth Choir, but you said this was a general fundraiser for
the music. Just to help support the general operations of the choir. But the choir is planning in collaboration with other community members who may not be members of the Alaska Youth Choir. There will be the King Island Christmas Oratorio coming up at the end of November and into December.
It's got a lot of the Alaska Youth Choir students singing in it.
That's right. That's right. And it's conducted by Missouri, who is the artistic director for the Alaska Youth Choir as well. So,
and then there are plans afoot to for them to go to Scotland in the summer.
I believe so, right? To bring the King Island Christmas Oratorio over to Scotland for the Fringe Festival
and the Alaska Youth Choir. Both groups kind of in conjunction. They're going to sing some pieces together, as I understand it, and appear at the Fringe Festival in Edinburgh.
Right.
So it sounds like a wonderful thing for people to be supporting. And here's a chance to get some money into the Alaska Youth Choir and also to cause your eye sockets to explode once again with the whole Lord of the Rings movie marathon. Here it is, the very tail end of the thing. Music you're hearing in the background tells us that it's time to look at another aspect of Juno's self-reliance. For the next several programs, we're going to examine issues of energy. When we began doing these programs on sustainability, we started by interviewing a number of people at the last farmer's market, which was held at the Jack in late October. A number of people that we interviewed identified one of the keys to Juno's self-reliance as hydroelectric power. To find out more about Juno's hydroelectric power capabilities, we interviewed Alec Mesteg. He's the Energy Services Specialist with AEL&P. We caught up with Alec at the Salmon Creek Powerhouse. It's a 4-megawatt turbine. It's driven from a penstock below the powerhouse from the Salmon Creek Dam. We asked Alec if there was a way to quantify the amount of hydroelectric power that Juno has in reserve.
With Lake Dorothy online right now, we do have a pretty good ability to meet the town's demand, which is the amount of power that the town would need at any given moment. And then also, you know, in times where there's a lot of water, we have the ability to supply Greens Creek. One of the things that probably our biggest limiting factor is in the amount of water that we're able to store, which is essentially the amount of energy or kilowatt hours that we can provide to the community.
And what controls our ability to store water? What is it, the capacity of the reservoirs? What is it that limits our ability to generate our own power from water?
It's both the capacity of the reservoirs, the amount of rainfall and snow melt in any given year, and the drainage basin into those reservoirs.
When we don't have enough water capability to generate our own power, then do we have to fall back on diesel?
That's the general idea, but overall it's a little bit more complicated than that, because I think a lot of people in town are familiar with the idea that Greens Creek is an interruptible load, and some of the other there are a number of dual fuel customers still in town who are small interruptible loads, so there's a little bit of an ability to kind of to change what the load is in Juno right now, so that we're able to, I guess, maybe better utilize the resource is a way to put it. When it comes to, especially with heaters, space heating, when it comes to it comes time to fire up diesels, anyone who is on a dual fuel, you know, that's a time where they definitely want to switch to oil, because if we are operating our diesels, then we are producing electricity and we're using that electricity to heat homes, then we're doing that much less efficiently than homes can utilize that diesel directly for space heating, because oil boilers are quite a bit more efficient than our diesel generators.
Is there a next step for Juno? In other words, we brought on, I think we have like three major power sources. Am I correct? I don't know how many how many hydroelectric power sources we actually tap into.
Well, there are there's a number of distributed smaller hydro projects that are, you know, have been around for a very long time. And then the two, you know, the major hydro resources for the town are Snettisham and Lake Dorothy. And so there are other projects that are out there. One of the things about hydro that I've heard said a lot around the office now is essentially it inflates until you build the project, and they are very, very expensive to construct. But, you know, the nice thing about them is once you do construct them, the fuel is free. And so it's nice that we're able to take advantage of that in Juneau, and, it definitely brings an upside to the ring.
It sounds like in many ways we pay not for the power that we're using, but for the construction of the facility to generate the power.
And also just the operation and maintenance of the facility. You know, some of the smaller, older projects are, you know, getting up to 100 years, and they're still operating and providing power to the town. And I think it speaks highly to, you know, and me being new to ALMP and really being exposed to this for the first time, even though I grew up here, I have just been so impressed with the quality of the maintenance and the just, I guess, going out and actually getting in to see the facilities to see how well maintained they are and how long these facilities have been operating, how long they will continue to operate, I think is certainly a great benefit to the community.
I think power customers were quite surprised when the avalanche took out that one tower and interrupted our power from at least one of our hydro sources. But the response from AALP has been to build the necessary diversion systems. What's the status of that construction?
There are two that are in place, and I believe the foundation for a third one is in place. Those are, you know, they're relatively simple when you look at them. You know, you've seen the photo of them. It's a big wedge in front of a tower, but they're huge, and it takes a lot to get them out there, and it's a difficult place to work. So we've already seen one. Last year there was an avalanche, and the diversion structure appears to have spared the town from another. Another issue with that line, and then hopefully, if we get more of these up in some of the key areas, then it'll continue to provide a benefit to the community.
Alec, what do you think the next step is for AELNP? What's on the horizon?
Well, I think, with me coming on the AELNP, I think one of the things that we're really keen on is understanding that we can meet part of our load growth through conservation. And that is by far the most cost-effective way to deal with. You know, it's a lot cheaper to save electricity and to use the resource more effectively than it is to build new generation. So that's one thing that we really want to key on. You know, and we see a lot of things coming over. And when we look at load growth, you know, we look at not only how are we currently utilizing the resource, but what are the new loads that are coming on, and. We would like to see the best utilization of the resource, and I think for the most part, one of the things that when we look at maybe a shifting fuels, you know, if people are looking to get away from diesel and come on to electricity, then we would like to see that happen on the transportation side more so than on the space heating side, because right now people's space heaters in their homes are quite a bit more efficient than their gas or diesel powered vehicles. So if you shift a 20% efficient gas engine over to electricity, well, that's a much better utilization because the electric vehicle is going to be quite a bit more efficient. So you're going to need a smaller input of energy to get the same output essentially. So I think that's something that that our hydro system can handle. That's a load that our hydro system can handle quite a bit more easily. Than to bring on a whole bunch of space heating to, you know, with resistance heat. So
there's evidently a special rate, or at least you call it on the website an experimental rate for people with electric vehicles. Is that are there more incentives like that that you're planning on that would encourage people to shift to electric vehicles?
Right now, with just a couple electric vehicles in town, we are using that experimental rate to just kind of get some information about how these vehicles are operating. We have the Chevy Volt that you know, our president Tim McLeod drives around, and a lot of us in the office have had the opportunity to drive, and I think a few people in the community have had the opportunity to drive it. It's great, you know, and to be honest, electric vehicles in Juneau is a lot different than down south, where, you know, you have the ability to drive to the next town and stuff like that, where some of that longer range might be more, you know, utilized more often, more frequently. But when you're driving around Juneau, typically you're not driving as far as you would be down there. So it, you know, they are an effective way to get around in Juneau. I think when I took the Volt home for a weekend for an energy, you know, to haul some stuff around and then go to an energy fair, and I was really impressed. You know, I mean, it's nice to drive. It's a nice car, and it was incredibly cheap. You know, I was just looking at it the other day. I think they, you know, that car has gone probably 3,000 to 4,000 miles over the last 3 to 4 months, and it's used, you know, I think less than 5 gallons of gas, and that's a Chevy Volt, so it does have the gas engine to charge the batteries when you're getting low. And this time of year, it starts getting colder. The car uses more energy to condition the batteries, and then also to heat the car and things like that. So it doesn't get quite the same range as it does in the summertime. But in the summertime, it's basically not using any fuel at all, except to just kind of turn the engine on and make sure it's not getting stagnant.
So electric transportation at an individual level could be done with automobiles. Is there anything afoot to bring in large electric vehicles like buses or trucks or those sorts of things?
You know, there are like diesel electric hybrids, and I've talked to some produce distributors in Oregon that have utilized those, and they like them. I think that's something I don't know a lot about just yet, just what's out there and how effective they are and things like that. But I think there's an opportunity to learn a little bit more about whether or not that could be utilized in Juneau. My guess is it you know, those vehicles probably could be. I think we're always going to have, or at least, you know, for the time being, for the foreseeable future, we're going to have a need for large diesel engines and a need to use fuel. I think it's not, at this point, until the technology improves, we're not really necessarily looking to say all vehicles or all transportation in Juneau needs to be something other than petroleum fueled, but really just, you know, where the opportunities are, we should start making that change, because the less money that we send out of this town, the better.
Alec, are there other steps that people can take besides going out and buying a battery-operated vehicle to conserve more power?
Oh, absolutely. And you know, don't get me wrong, but buying a battery-operated vehicle doesn't necessarily conserve power, I mean, because you're shifting that load to electricity. But you know, there's a lot of things that people can do. I think a lot of people kind of underestimate their opportunities to improve their how much electricity they're using for lighting. I think there's a lot of opportunity to improve the envelopes of residences and buildings so that we aren't heating the outdoors as much as we are right now. It's a long list, you know, what your opportunities are. Many of them are relatively simple. Some of them are pretty difficult. But when it comes to taking a 2x4 home and trying to improve the insulative quality of the envelope, that can be kind of difficult. And, you know, there are some things that really, there isn't a terribly great amount of information out there about how to best do that. You know, when you look at the Cold Climate Housing Research Center, a lot of the information that they provide is based on data that they took up in Fairbanks, which doesn't necessarily equate to how wet our climate and more moderate our climate is down here. So it's, you know, it's not an easy question sometimes. Some of the things are pretty easy. Just, getting programmable thermostats, I can't say enough how important that is. You know, you don't need to be heating your house at the same level all times of the day, whether or not you're there. I think there's a really easy and cheap way to reduce the amount of energy that you're using. And then there's also just some behavior changes. If you recognize that you need to start conserving, whether it's just to reduce the number of green, you know, the amount of fuel that you're burning, or if it's to reduce the amount of money that you're spending on energy, I think there's a lot of opportunity to really look at how you're using energy, how carefully you are looking at your behavior and how it impacts your energy use.
Alec, anything else you want to talk to folks about as far as sustainability for Juneau?
Well, there's all kinds of things. I think, you know, if anyone does have questions about their specific home or business, you know, I certainly want to talk to you on an individual level, because so much of how we use energy and how our buildings use energy is site-specific. You know, all the way down to how much sun does your lot get, how exposed you are, what are your windows like. All those things are really site-specific. There are some generalities in how we use energy, but when it comes to how does your building or your structure or your home improve the or reduce the amount of energy that it's consuming, you know, a lot of times that's a one-on-one interaction to determine what's best for your situation.
Is there a charge from AALNP for doing that sort of thing?
No. I'm out here just to do what I can to help people who are looking to find new ways to reduce the amount of money that they're spending on energy.
And someone who wants to take advantage of that would contact you how?
They could call just our main line at 780-2222, or my direct office line is 463-6303.
And your email?
My email is alec.mesdag@aelp.com.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
We've been talking with Alec Mesdag. He's the Energy Services Specialist at AELNP. If you have questions for Alec, you can reach him at 780-2222 or 463-6303. And his email is alec.mesdag@aelp.com. Tune in next Tuesday as we continue our examination of the energy aspects of Juno's sustainability. Tune with KTOO in Juneau, Alaska. It's about 8 minutes before 4 o'clock. This is Juneau Afternoon, and my next guest is the principal at Glacier Valley Elementary School. Ted Wilson is here with me. Hi, Ted.
Hello. Thank you.
Tell me a little bit about what Glacier Valley is up to at this point.
Well, we're pretty busy. You heard from Lori Hagee last week with her jam program, which Music Matters, and all of the clay club and jumping bears and clinket drumming and dancing and violins and all of those things that she has going on along with other staff at our school. But we also have a breakfast club that we run in the morning that's a volunteer breakfast club that is one of our pride and joys because it serves a lot of students that otherwise wouldn't get a breakfast. We have a state fruit and vegetable snack grant this year, and so we also are able to provide students fruit and vegetable snack every day during the school year, which is pretty exciting for us this year. And we also have going on a lot of curricular work that we've been doing in the classroom with teachers, and new work that over the last 3 years that we've been doing in reading, and then this year a new math program that we've been implementing, and a lot of professional development for the teachers so that they know exactly how to put that curriculum into place, how to assess it, how to know how to help all students enter into that curriculum so they get the learning that they need. And then when you have days like today where it snows and snows, you have a lot of excitement at recess as well.
Well, I should mention that we have a winter weather advisory now that starts at 3 a.m. and runs until noon Wednesday. What it's basically saying is that the snow is going to continue and that we will probably get a total accumulation of about 2 inches. So, as always, I'm sure people are looking out the window saying, snow day tomorrow? Snow day tomorrow?
Yeah, probably take more than that, but yeah. The kids still enjoy it when it first comes. And, yeah. Recess becomes popular all of a sudden when instead of being out in the rain, they're out in the snow.
So. Do you let them, can they have snowball fights?
They cannot have snowball fights.
No
what
snowball
they can fight. Do is they can roll their snow on the ground and make snow creations.
All right.
But as far as picking it up, that's really discouraged.
That's discouraged. Okay. Well, good. So you've been principal for a while at
yes.
at Glacier Valley. 10 years, I think.
10 years as yeah. principal, and before that, 6 years in the classroom at Glacier Valley. So I've been at Glacier Valley for quite a while,
yeah.
and fourth and fifth grade most of my time in the classroom.
Has the school changed a great deal in the 16 years you've been there?
Well, we went through 3 years of major renovation, and so the look of the school inside and out changed quite a bit. Adding a commons where we didn't have one before, which cost us a couple of classroom spaces, which went like this year when the school board voted to add a new teacher. That's a little bit of a challenge at the same time because we're up to about 400 students now, and so you need to figure out how you're going to, where you're going to put all of the classrooms, all the specialists and everything. But the commons was well worth it because it's a very versatile space. You get the lunch out of the gym, so you can have a lot more gym classes, which we desperately need. Curriculum-wise, we've become a lot more organized with curriculum over the last several years and with assessment and having a much better idea of where students are and where we need to take them next. And so I've been happy with the progress we've made there. And teachers at Glacier Valley being really collaborative in their work together so that we can make decisions that are going to be beneficial to the students, and because they can work together, we can be a lot more flexible with what we're going to do in our programs. So I think those types of things have grown over the years that I've been there. I feel like we're in a really good place right now.
How much of that growth did you have to kind of learn as you went along, as opposed to being prepared for it?
Was that... It is definitely on-the-job learning. There were things that in my programs, that philosophies that the programs imparted, but then there's just watching teachers teach and students learn, and then looking at research that is coming along all the time, new research all the time, and looking at situations and asking folks to try something different and then look at what happens when you do that different thing. And if it works, then you build around it. And so that's been how I've done it, is to watch what happens when teachers and students interact. Things that look really good, okay, let's do more of that. Let's spread that and let's talk about how to make that even better. Things that seem to be less effective, it's like, okay, so let's do less of that. Let's replace that with something else. And so it is constantly just watching, learning, testing, and refining.
Ted, last minute of our conversation here, are there any events coming up at Glacier Valley that you want folks to be part of?
Well, we do have a concert tomorrow that's our kindergarten and second grade, which is part of our jam and violin, and that's at 12:30 at the school. that is our biggest thing right now. We'll have something happening in December, but we have not set any dates for December yet. The last thing I do want to remind folks, though, is that next week is Parent Conference Week. And so Monday is a day off for students. Teachers will be working on getting report cards ready. And then Tuesday and Wednesday of next week are the parent conferences. And then, of course, we have Thanksgiving and a day after off. So if they haven't gotten their conference dates, they want to contact their teacher and make sure that they have that date set up so they can find out how their child has been doing.
Really good. Ted Wilson, principal at Glacier Valley Elementary School. Thanks for updating us on the school.
All right, thank you.
Andy Klein's got a good lineup of guests tomorrow on Juno Afternoon. You'll get details on the latest release from Absinthe Films. Theater at Latitude 58, Once Upon a Mattress will be here in the Northern Light Church Bazaar. No Umbrellas Fashion Show, and the fundraiser coming up for Love Incorporated. This is KTOO Juno. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juno and Douglas, and we also broadcast on a set of translators throughout the area. We're on 103.1 megahertz K276 AF in the Valley and Auk Bay, 101.7 K269 AO in Lemon and Schweitzer Creek. Gustavus is at 88.1 on K201 AM. K220BT serves Hoonah at 91.9 in an Excursion Inlet in Icy Strait. KTOO is on K210 AS at 89.9.